views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
because they are hard. Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program, and I am David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we're in for a really interesting discussion tonight because I've already had parts of it, and I heard our guests talk about it at the New Space Conference, which you have heard me talk quite a bit about since it happened in mid-June of this year. First, a couple of very quick announcements. 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free line. That is our preferred way of communicating with our guests. So let me repeat it. 1-866-687-7223. And remember to be patient. There are no call screeners, and I'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. Also, email is okay, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and our blog on our website, thespaceshow.com. So to access that, it's all the way to the far right to upcoming shows. It's a menu item. Click on the first show listed, that is tonight's program, and then all the way down to the bottom is the place for comments, because that is our archive page for the program tonight. As soon as you click send on that, I'll get your question or comment and can bring it up with our guest as soon as possible and work it into the show. So also go to our website, thespaceshow.com. So we do have a very detailed website newsletter there, and you'll see it center right. And the first part of that newsletter are details for the programs for this week. And then if you scroll down, it will show all our coming events that are already booked and confirmed going through to the end of the year. And we are aggressively booking October, November, and December shows already. I think we're already full for the rest of this month as well as for September and about half of October. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download our programs. Upper left menu, there is a menu item under support. For our Space Show store, if you're interested in t-shirts and logo wear items. Listen Live is in that upper left menu. There are some additions there. So that tells you how to listen to a live show, how to listen to an archive show, and how to do podcasting. So those instructions are there. The new addition to all of that is for those of you who use Alexa, we are available in TuneIn. I must say their customer service is a little bit to go on the want side for, because we have been trying for more than a week to get them to give us the coding and the instructions for our channel and our embedded TuneIn player, and we don't get that from them. And I'm about to send another email to their customer service department. But it is already playing. I've heard from listeners who tell me that they can get the Space Show through TuneIn. So I caution you, there is an Australian radio program by the same name, The Space Show. So make sure if you're, and they're also in TuneIn. So make sure that if you're listening to the Space Show channel, you're listening to the one here in the United States in California, not the one in Australia. If any of you know the guys in Australia, I'd love to talk to them. I think that'd be a fun Space Show program. So if any of you know them, any of our Australian friends are listening, send me an email. And if you can introduce me, cool. If not, when I get a chance, I'll send them a blind note and see if Space Show, the Space Show, can talk with one another and do a show together. Remember also, the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do support us with your contributions. If you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a federal tax deduction through the IRS For those of you paying taxes in California, we're a public benefit corporation here, and you do get a tax benefit there as well. You can see the information for supporting us on the website, Center Right, and the PayPal address. It also has a mailing address for those of you who prefer paper through checks. And we thank you for your support. And without it, I promise you we would not be doing the space show. There's also a huge Amazon button in the center page, and that's because Amazon has great programs for nonprofits. Click on it, and you'll go to our nonprofit page on onegiantleapfoundation.org, and it gives you the instructions on both of the Amazon programs that the space show has with Amazon. And if you can do any of your routine shopping or books or anything like that through one of those Amazon programs, they donate a portion of your purchase price to the nonprofit of your choice, which in this case would be One Giant Leap Foundation, the space show. And we thank you very much for that support. And we also have corporate sponsors, so check out the banner ads going across our website. And remember to read what's underneath those banner ads by clicking on it from time to time. Our sponsors do change their messages, and we wouldn't be doing the show without the great support of our sponsors. To that end, the New Worlds Conference, which is in Austin, Texas, November 10th through the 11th, I think it's part of the Austin State Fair, is a sponsor, and their website, newworlds2017.space, very, very cool conference put on and created by Rick Tomlinson, so do check that one out. The Integrated Space Plan is also a sponsor. Remember, they have the detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space, which includes Earth to orbit, reusable space transportation, development of the moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt, space settlements, and much more. Go to their website where all of this is, and that is thespaceplan.com. You can view their interactive online plan, but you can also buy a full-size poster of the space plan. Remember that not only is it full color and really cool, it has been updated as of ISDC in May, so this is the new integrated space plan. And I also understand they have a space plan, an integrated space plan for children. So if you have kids and you want to get them interested in some of this space activity early on, what a great way to do that. Again, thespaceplan.com. And the Space Foundation sponsors us, and they've got their 34th symposium just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th at the Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. Check it out at spacesymposium.org. Remember, August 30th through the 31st, they have a commercial business two-day seminar workshop in San Francisco at the Marriott Hotel. If you're planning to be there, do let me know. Send me an email, and I'll get you my cell phone number so we can meet up. And this looks like it's going to be a pretty good event for commercial space and investment in space. You can read about it at their webpage, spacefoundation.org. And so that brings me to our guest tonight, and I'm really happy to bring Bruce Pittman back on the show. It's been a while since Bruce has been with us, but he is a great guest, and he is currently working as a contractor at NASA Ames, where he is the chief system engineer in the NASA Space Portal Office. In this position, he supports the Space Technology Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters on programs ranging from orbital applications of the International Space Station and other orbiting commercial facilities to low-cost, reliable access to space, reusable space infrastructure, as well as cislunar commercialization. The Space Portal's latest initiative is a plan for returning to the moon using public-private partnerships. Bruce also leads the Space Portal support of the Frontier Development Lab Summer Study Program, which is associated with the SETI Institute. His full bio is on our website for this show tonight. I urge you to read and check out all of Bruce's very interesting activities and his career, which has really been an amazing career. And Bruce, really great to have you back on the show tonight. I have been talking a lot about the New Space Conference. I was pretty impressed with all the entrepreneurs there, the panels of entrepreneurs, young people, the diversity of many of those panels. And you were part of many of those panels. And even me, who does a show four or five times a week for 17 years, Bruce, I was stunned at all the opportunities and the trends that are developing in new space. So that's what we talked about on the show tonight. This is really different over the last couple of years, and new space really opened my eyes to even more than what I thought was going on.
No, that's true, David. Well, it's good to be on your show again, and let me start with my usual disclaimer that all the views here are mine, and I'm not representing anybody else on the show tonight, so this is all my thoughts and my ideas. But no, I'm really excited. I have been, you know, if you read my bio, you can see I've been pushing this rock up this hill for a long time, starting back in the kind of early to mid 80s with commercial space. And it took a lot longer than a lot of us had thought or hoped that to get where we are today. But I think you are beginning to see I'm hoping we're reaching the tipping point and we're picking up velocity and a lot of neat things are happening. A lot of new players are coming into the game. The barriers to entry have been greatly reduced to allow more people to entree. There's a lot more investment capital that's available than there was in the past. So I think, you know, we pretty much have a perfect storm.
Is the investment capital coming in based on anticipation, or are there actually new space commercial ventures now returning nice profits to investors other than having the government as their sole customer?
I think it's a combination depending on which market segment that you're looking at. I think for some of the small sat and earth observing markets, I think that there are, you know, real customers paying real money. I don't know about the profitability of those, but certainly I think the people that are making those investments see the potential for that profitability. You know, the launch vehicle business is a little tougher, the investment's bigger, but SpaceX says that they're, you know, both profitable and cash flow positive. You know, they had their couple little hiccups there, that accidents that they seem to have recovered from, and their launch cadence is picking up. But you know, if you're just looking for, you know, really, you know, certain returns, you know, then go invest in government securities and everything. Space is now, and I think will be for the foreseeable future, still a risky investment. But I think that a lot of people are beginning to see that there is a real upside potential, and that there's money to be made there.
If you look at the total sort of emerging commercial space, new space arena, where are the strongest trends? Is it the small sats and CubeSats and Earth imaging, or are other sectors emerging?
So I think that's clearly one. You know, it's in the Earth observing, you know, with, Planet just bought Terabella from Google. And so you're seeing some consolidation, you know, going on there with some of these. One of the companies that spun out of here was three summer students that came here from the International Space University in 2012, Peter Platzer and two of his colleagues, and they formed what turned out to be Spire. And they've gone for a maritime kind of application with some weather-related technology using GPS occultation. But then there's the Google Lunar X Prize guys that are still out there, the asteroid mining guys that are still out there, Bob Bigelow and the new Axiom guys, you know, Mike Sefardini are looking at habitats in space. So I think there's a wide variety of things. And then one of the things that just launched last week to the ISS that I think is really exciting is the maiden space guys are going to be trying to pull fiber optic cable, a new exotic blend called Z-Blan in microgravity up on the ISS. And if they can do that, we could see the beginning of actual space manufacturing.
How do they do that? Do you know how that program works or project works?
Well, it's basically similar to what you do here. You're trying to pull the fiber from a boule, you know, it's called a preform, of this material, and then you heat up the end of it and you pull on it. On Earth, you can just use gravity, but up in space, you actually have to pull on it. They're going to try to make this the Z-Blan fiber optics cable up on the International Space Station. I think their goal is to make like 100 or more meters of this cable for testing.
Pretty amazing. So does the space station use any fiber optics cable in their wiring? Do they use any at all for anything?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Or is this going to be a big-time new event?
I think, you know, so this is basically just an experiment. I think that given the technology that's in the International Space Station, I would seriously doubt if there's any fiber optics, at least in the operational part. Maybe some of the experiments or some of the equipment up there uses it, but I don't think it's part of the actual part of the space station. But yeah, I think you're going to start to see more and more of those kinds of things. The other one is they're doing a protein crystallization experiment with one of the proteins that's associated with Parkinson's disease, and this is another CASIS sponsored research where they're helping to try out this technology to see if they can crystallize this this particular protein and help with the help to fight Parkinson's disease.
Are you seeing any emerging opportunities or possible trends, other than Google Lunar X Prize, of course, that involve lunar activities or maybe even looking ahead to Martian activities?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing that I think everybody is kind of focusing on right now is lunar volatiles, particularly water in the permanently shadowed regions at the poles of the moon. So I think that's what everybody's looking at. And, in our office here, we did we do this NASA research announcement. And so in 2014, we gave a research, and one of the respondents to our NRA was selected, and it was Charles Miller and his company, Next Gen Space LLC, and he put together a really amazing team, and they came up with a thing called evolvable lunar architecture. And so they went through a whole scenario about how you could, you know, what it would take to actually harvest stuff from the moon and do that and kind of how you might commercialize that to help provide propellant in lunar orbit that then could be used to refuel vehicles that were headed to Mars, and could that be used to reduce the cost of going to Mars. So I thought that was kind of an intriguing idea. So that's obviously not a thriving market right now, but if you do get the cislunar economy going and people are looking for lower cost transportation, then the ability to be able to have reusable vehicles and to be able to refuel those vehicles could be a really, I think, lucrative market in the future.
A new market that I came across at New Space, which also surprised me, and I met, I think, three different companies doing this. I can't say they're really young millennials and entrepreneurs. They're more seasoned people. But this is providing sort of turnkey ground station communications with SmallSat and CubeSat users and handling all of their communications and maintenance and other kinds of things with ground stations that they have in strategic locations around the planet. Is that a pretty new thing that's developing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the challenges here is if you want to, you know, do small sats, do you really want to go to all the trouble of having to set up your own communications, you know, network and all the ground stations? So what they're basically saying is, you know, you focus on the CubeSat part and we'll focus on the communications part. So I think this is kind of where you see the synergies or the sub-markets emerging here as people see, hey, there's a need here, and if I go in and I can show a really cost-effective way of doing this, you know, that they're and I can get customers, then there can be a good market here for these kinds of services, and I think you're seeing more and more of that.
Jack is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's going to be our first email questioner for the evening, and he says, Bruce, can you determine, or do you know, or can you do a best guess as what motivates the younger entrepreneurs to go into these various space businesses? Are they after making a killing in the financial markets, or does something else inspire them? What's your take on why you're seeing so many young people wanting to start up a new space company?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer, but I would say it's a combination of things. I don't think there's any one motivation. I think if your sole goal is just to, as Elon has said, if your sole goal is to make money, there's easier ways to do it than space. So I think there has to be more than just making money. I think there has to be something about space and the excitement and the dynamic nature of the business that attracts people to it. And, you know, it is cool, you know, or at least most of the people that are probably listening to this call think it's cool. There's probably a lot of people out there that think we're crazy, but there is a cool factor to it as well. But I think it's also that it's kind of in a new and emerging market. So rather than having to duke it out in well-established you know, venues where the main players have everything pretty well locked up, now you see a new and emerging market where there may be more opportunities, there may be more chances for newcomers to come in and find a niche for themselves out there in the marketplace. So I think that emerging nature of it and the how quickly it's moving now, I think, is also attracting people. And as I mentioned, the barriers to entry, the cost of entering this, both from a time and a money and expertise kind of a point of view has been greatly lowered over the last, you know, 10 or 20 years. And so now you can come in and you can do something in you know, a few months to a year or two. And as I said, you know, Spire started off in 2012 here as some summer students with kind of a dream, and now they've got 34 satellites in orbit and they've raised over $50 million. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing. The Planet guys also were some researchers here at NASA Ames that, and some of the work they had done saw the potential of this, so they said, why don't we go start our own company? So they left, came up with a new product and, you know, with their Dove spacecraft, which are really small, they were able to attract, some really top tier, investment like Draper Fisher Jurvetson. Steve Jurvetson saw some real potential in them and invested in this. And now they have 200 satellites on orbit. And that was started in, I think it was 2010.
Pretty amazing. I noticed that, a lot of the people on the panels that were the entrepreneurs that the foundation had chosen to speak there said that doing something that they felt where they could make a difference was really important to them, and they thought that they could make a bigger difference faster in space than they could with most terrestrial opportunities. You probably heard them say things like that too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that starting a new space company, being a new space entrepreneur, and doing things like what Spire is doing and Planet and Maiden Space and, you know, a handful of others, does it make a big difference? I guess you're talking about making a difference for the world. I don't know what else they'd be talking about. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it certainly could. You know, if you kind of go back in time, you know, 10 years, you know, to the mid, you know, part of the first decade of this thing, you know, when the iPhone and everything was coming out, then the big rage was, well, let's come up with a new app, and you sit down and you write a new app and you make a lot of money. But I think everybody's kind of gotten tired of that, and is my whole thing just coming up with a new app that's just like the 500 other apps that are out there that pretty much do what mine did? So I think this is one of those things where you can see at least the potential for making a bigger impact on the world. I mean, look at Planet's vision is to basically image the entire Earth every day. I mean, that's a pretty amazing goal, and they're pretty much in that thing with some of these large communications networks that Boeing and SpaceX and some of these other ones, OneWeb, trying to do is basically connect the entire world to the internet. You know, the 3 billion people that don't have access to the internet. So there's a bunch of these kind of things where you can say, wow, that's a pretty amazing, you know, potential. And my favorite one is Jeff Bezos's vision, that actually came out of a summer study that was held here at Ames and at Stanford in 75. I'm sure you're well aware of that, the space settlement one, of millions of people living and working in thriving communities beyond the Earth. I mean, that's a really remarkable vision, and Bezos is actually setting out to go enable that to happen and putting in the transportation infrastructure to make that happen. I mean, that really blew my mind when I first heard that, and that he had been pursuing this since he was in high school.
Another question is from Carly in Phoenix, Arizona. And Carly says, Bruce, if you were possibly a high school guidance counselor and with your expertise that you have, let's say you retired from NASA and became a high school guidance counselor, and a couple of students, regardless of race or gender or anything like that, came to you and said that they're looking for possible careers that would be unique and different, and they weren't afraid of math or science, but they hadn't necessarily specialized in math or science. Would you unload space ideas on them, or how would you treat introducing them or maybe refraining from that to possible high school graduates looking for some potential study options and maybe career options as they go to college?
No, I would feel very comfortable doing that and recommending space. One of the things, I mean, you know, it's amazing because that's actually how I got started. I remember when I was a senior in high school, which was a long time ago, it was a really bad time in the aerospace industry. You know, Apollo had just, you know, happened, and there was PhD aerospace engineers, you know, driving cabs in New York. And I went into my high school guidance counselor and said, you know, I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. And I thought the guy was going to have me committed. But the neat thing about that is, you know, even if you're studying to be an engineer or even an aerospace engineer, and that's the other thing, to be in aerospace, you do not have to be an aerospace engineer. You know, they need all kinds of electrical engineers. Software is a really big piece. So you can go study whatever pretty much you want as far as a technical field goes and still find a place in the space industry. And that allows you to keep your options open, where if it turns out there is an opportunity in aerospace, you can go do that. But if it turns out you get another opportunity or there aren't any, you know, really attractive opportunities, then, you know, you can still find a job in another industry. I mean, I think that any kind of technical degree, and I'm prejudiced. I'm an engineer, so I'm kind of partial to engineering, but it's a very versatile degree, and it allows you to go do a wide variety of things, and you can go try things out and just see, you know, how does this feel. But the other part I would encourage people to do is one, don't get so focused on this, and, you know, go talk to people that are in the industry, go do some internships, go do some, if there's still co-op programs or something like that where you can actually get some hands-on experience, because I think it's a real shame to go through a whole educational program and then find out that you may have liked being a student, but you don't like, you know, being in that industry. I actually had this one happen to me. Is one of the guys that I worked with when I first came to NASA as a civil servant back in the 70s. He really had enjoyed being an engineering student, and he'd gone through and he got a master's degree in engineering, and he hated being an engineer.
Interesting. Why did he hate being an engineer? I guess that would be the logical question.
I think it was because it was too open-ended to him. He liked the thing that there was always a right answer, and the answer was always somewhere in that book. And the fact that, you know, there was no book that you had to kind of make it up as you went along or figure out which was the right book to go to. I think it was just a little too unstructured for him. And maybe it was just NASA and we were kind of doing some really pretty far out there stuff. And maybe I never did find out what happened to him, but that always struck me is that trying to get some grounding and make sure that, you know, you're really doing something that you feel excited about, you know, going to work every day. I mean, that's, I think, one of the greatest joys in life. If you can find something that you can make a decent living at and you can, you know, look forward to going to work every day and you work with some really great people, I think that's one of the greatest gifts in life.
Bruce, do you think this trend and the opportunities that we've been talking about, are they here to stay? Do you think they could be like a bubble and, you know, in 2 years all this great momentum is going to die down, or regulations are going to come in and stomp it out, or, you know, something may happen? Or do you think we're looking at a long-term trend here?
Well, in all of these things, there tends to be, you know, peaks and valleys. And so I can't say that there's not going to be some bumps on the road. I don't see this as a bubble. You know, clearly, like, let's take small launch vehicles. I think that there's a whole bunch of people that are chasing after that market. And I do believe there's a market there, but not for the number of people that are chasing it. So, I mean, there's going to be in any, you know, of these new emerging markets, and a bunch of people are racing to get the pole position, you know, there's going to be some winners and some losers. So you've already started to see that. Some of the companies are already going. Firefly, you know, went down, but I heard, you know, I was just reading something today that they may be coming back. X-Core fell on some hard times and is basically laid off their staff. If you remember back to Armadillo, now those guys have spun off a new company called Exos. Some of the people from there. So there's going to be peaks and valleys, and not everybody's going to win. I do not want to make it, you know, sound at all like if you know, you start a company that, you know, in 3 years you're going to be a millionaire. A lot of these things fail, and it is a tough business. It is very competitive. And, you know, for every success story, there's probably a dozen, if not 100, you know, companies that swung and missed. So I don't want to give the false impression here that everything is sweetness and roses and success is guaranteed. But if it really calls to you, but then you don't have to start the company, that you could go work for a company. And this is the other thing I would say, before you go and you start a company, you know, and do a Steve Jobs kind of thing where, you know, the first company you work for is basically your company that you found. It's a lot easier to learn on somebody else's dime, and all that than it is to learn on your own. So I think going out into industry and getting your spurs and you know, learning, you know, what the industry is all about is a really good thing, and then figuring out what you really want to do, what are you really passionate about, I think makes a lot of sense. But there's some people that just know what they want to do and they just kind of want to go do it, but it's not for everybody.
Jim is in Memphis, and he says, are you starting to see any trends develop or opportunities develop for human spaceflight in the entrepreneurial commercial new space sector?
Yeah, I am. You know, if you kind of look at the infrastructure that's being put in place, particularly, you know, if you've been following the commercial crew program that NASA's funding there, both Boeing and SpaceX are planning to be testing their vehicles next year to fly people to orbit and from American soil. I think that's a really big deal. You've got companies like Bigelow Aerospace and Axiom and some other people that are looking about this, the deep space habitat. There's been a number of studies that NASA's released, you know, doing that, and companies like NanoRacks are in there, as well as some of the big aerospace companies like Lockheed. So there's a lot of, I think, activity that's going in that direction. How quickly this market is going to develop, You know, nobody knows what's the cost going to be for some of these things, and how is could cost come down over time, especially when you add reusability. I think one of the most intriguing things is looking at Jeff Bezos's New Glenn vehicle, and look at the potential that could have for the tourism market.
But it's probably slower trending and sparser with opportunities than some of the imaging and satellite types of opportunities that are emerging, correct?
Yeah, but again, it depends on what you're looking for. If you were looking for what's called a blue ocean, you know, with a spot where there's nobody at right now, then you don't go for the existing markets, you go for the emerging markets. So you got to just decide what game you want to play in and what where you want to take the risk, either with going in a more established market, but there may be more competition and all that, or going to a more open field, but a less well-established and maybe more market risk there. So just kind of it's good to have options. It's good to have choices.
This may be a night for email and not phone calls, although listeners, phone is our preferred way, 866-687-7223. So Randy is in Cleveland, and he said David has done lots of shows talking about AI and new manufacturing techniques, 3D printing, as well as CRISPR technology. Do you see a potential for any of this really cutting edge but maybe fringe stuff to start showing up in the new space arena anytime soon, or is it still pretty far out there for coming into the space arena?
No, I think there's a lot of interest right now in trying to bring some of these technologies in. One of the things that we just did, we just finished up a program last week with the SETI Institute, where we were looking at applying, you know, machine learning and machine intelligence to space science and exploration. So we did a mashup with five different teams looking at different aspects on this. Some of them were looking at planetary defense. Two teams were looking at space weather, and one team was looking at space resources. So I think that was an example. And if you go to the website frontierdevelopmentlab.org, I don't know if they're up there yet, but shortly, if they aren't up there now, they should shortly be. All of the presentations from the teams will be up there. It's all free, and you can go take a look and see, at least in this one area. We did one last year on machine learning, the same kind of thing, and we expanded it this year. We went from 6 weeks to 8 weeks, and it's really amazing to see. We call it an innovation accelerator. And just to show what a really talented group of folks that are really motivated can do in just 8 weeks, it was pretty pretty amazing.
Maybe some of them will be good space show guests. I'll go check out the website and see what is up there for doing that. Did 5 years ago, did you think you would be in the new space arena where you are today, or are you surprised?
Well, I've been, you know, kind of where I'm at. We've been working on this for like 12 years. So, here at the Space Portal. So I kind of knew I was here. I didn't quite know where everybody else was going to be. We started off as kind of the, you know, the people on the mountaintop kind of trying to tell everybody how great it was here. And it was a little bit, in the early days, it was a little bit, lonely. Because you know, we were kind of the only ones that were kind of going for this, but now there's a lot more people interested in this. So I think I'm not surprised that I'm here. I'm just surprised that kind of so many other people are here. I think that's the really exciting and somewhat surprising part.
I know that when I started the space show 17 years ago, most of what we talk about today wasn't even in our consciousness or awareness, and in talking commercial space, which we've done over the 17 years, we never talked about things that are happening today. I mean, even 2 years ago, we maybe talked about CubeSats, but they were sort of experimental little academic hobby things. And
yeah, they were kind of like toys. And yeah, you know, if you talk to the people that invented them, they had no idea that this would ever be a real thing. It was just a teaching tool that they developed to teach their students about how to what satellites were all about. And the idea that this would become the new standard was, you know, when you talk to Bob Twiggs, you know, those guys had no idea.
No idea. You have a caller on hold. And hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please? Hello?
All about. And the idea that
hold on, caller. We're not hearing you. Hello, caller. Stop talking.
Oh, no idea.
We're not hearing you.
Okay. Can you hear me? Hello?
Now I hear you.
It's I'm listening to you talk on the radio.
Oh, well, turn off.
I was waiting to hear you say something on the radio.
Turn off the radio. We're not in sync with the radio. You got to turn it off completely. Turn off the radio, Jim.
Okay, hold on. I'm turning it down.
Well, you got to turn it off. You cannot hear it. It's not in phase.
Yeah, it's turned off.
Okay. This is Jim Crucifulli from Hawaii, everybody. So good to talk to you again. How are you?
Aloha. Just fine. And, you know, I just wanted to mention the focus on the earlier discussion centered largely on the moon. And everything we're hearing internationally is that the moon is coming back on the table, a very logical step into the solar system and as a stepping stone to Mars, as well as a test bed for technologies that can help improve life on our home planet through planetary sustainability. So we're going to be hosting an international moon-based summit in Hawaii this coming October to enable a sustainable human settlement on the moon. It'll convene a team of leading scientists, entrepreneurs, and representatives from space agencies and associations worldwide to help advance the development and implementation of a multinational base on the moon. Our goal is to help build upon discussions and recommendations rather than duplicate from other forums that have been meeting worldwide, the Lunar Exploration and Analysis Group, or LEAG, the European Lunar Symposium, the International Space Development Conference, the New Space Symposium, the upcoming International Astronautical Congress in Adelaide, Australia, and other forums worldwide which are working to formulate and document an integrated strategy for establishing a multinational base on the moon, beginning with the development of a prototype moon base in Hawaii. So our discussions will focus on identifying key drivers and motivators, along with resources and milestones, both technological and organizational, that will be required to enable lunar-based operations, looking at opportunities to advance both public-private partnerships and multinational collaboration that can ultimately help reduce the costs, enhance the benefits, and hopefully accelerate timetables for future lunar missions toward realizing what Jeff Bezos and others have referred to as a sustainable space economy. And one of the key milestones I want to make sure we emphasize here is the formation of an international moon base alliance comprised of representatives that will be meeting at the summit that will continue to pursue the resources and milestones identified during the summit, as well as oversee the design and development of this prototype lunar base in Hawaii. So I'd be happy to discuss any questions you folks might have about the upcoming summit or the vision for a moon base.
Well, our guest is participating in that summit, correct?
He certainly is, and he's one of our keynote speakers. And Bruce, do you want to mention briefly what you're going to be addressing?
Yes, so we're going to be talking about this from a number of different perspectives. So on my talk, I'm going to be wearing my National Space Society hat and kind of look at this from kind of the organizational point of view, from a NGO kind of a perspective, or people that are interested in this but don't necessarily, this isn't their day job, and kind of the number of people out there that support this from these kinds of communities, I think is an interesting perspective, that just think that it's important, even though it's not what they're doing with their life or their career, but they think it's important, and these are the people that show up for the March Storm and those kinds of things that are willing to spend their own money to go to, you know, Washington to talk to the congresspeople and tell them why they think this is important, even though, you know, they don't have any direct, to get any direct benefit of it, from it monetarily, other than the satisfaction of doing something that they think is important.
Jim, are you live streaming any of this for people who are unable to get to Hawaii to see
it? Yes, we're trying to use Skype to help, you know, connect the world in these discussions. And again, this is what I'd like to call or consider as a launch pad to subsequent discussions. And this alliance that I was referring to, we're going to be having several working group discussions as part of the summit, and these working groups will continue beyond the summit to keep the momentum going in discussing various issues. And the four areas we've identified are basically space commerce, related politics, and, of course, science and technology to get us to the moon. So under commerce, we're going to be looking at commercialization and business dynamic issues and developmental resources. Under the political umbrella, we'll be talking about cultural and philosophical factors, public relations, organizational structure for the moon base and the alliance, and both interagency and public-private partnerships, which, of course, is driving a lot of space development today. And then, you know, under the science, clearly the geological and geographical factors are relating to establishing a base on the moon, and technological factors, the design and architectural factors, looking at robotics and surface system components, in situ resource utilization technologies, all those things we need to test and validate on the moon to be successful in exploring beyond the moon to Mars and elsewhere. And again, as taking this dual-use approach, some of the technologies we'll be testing on the moon related to additive manufacturing, renewable energy, broadband telecom, all the in-situ resource utilization technologies, all those can be applied on our home planet to improve our qualities of life here, and Lord knows they need improving. And that, again, comes under this rubric that NASA Ames has been talking about, planetary sustainability. So we think there's a tremendous opportunity here to launch several things and keep the discussion going beyond the summit.
Okay. Bruce, any comments for Jim on your part?
No, I think, you know, again, this is one of those, you know, number of efforts that are trying to figure out how to work together to make these, you know, big audacious kinds of dreams that everybody has come true. This is more than even a guy like Bezos, you know, it's more than he can do by himself. So I think it's going to take the efforts of a lot of people to do this. And whether you're a moon person, a Mars person, an asteroid person, or whatever, that there's a lot of overlap there, and there's a lot of things we have a lot more in common than we have differences. So I think that trying to find ways to work together and to collaborate, I think is the right way to go. And then looking at one, this new space economy, you know, that if you go back and you look at the recent NASA authorization language, it's the first time that I remember seeing that Congress you know, called one of the goals of NASA is to help enable a thriving space economy. And so when you start looking at, well, in order to do that, what kind of infrastructure and things are you going to need to be able to do that? That opens up some really interesting questions. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun trying to answer them.
Okay. Jim, anything else? Otherwise, thank you very much for your call in this evening.
Sure, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that come up about the summit.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate hearing from you.
Sure. Aloha.
I guess I should say aloha, too. Bruce, we're at the midway point, so this is a good point to take a short break. So, listeners, we are going to pause for about 3 minutes, and we will be back with Bruce. We do answer the phone during the break if you want to give us a call. So, again, that is 1-866-687-7223, and we will be right back. Please don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday evening Space Show program. Again, I'm your host, David Livingston. We have a couple of great sponsors for the second segment of the program tonight that I would like to call your attention to. One is Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies. They're known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is our sponsor. They're the world's largest professional society, and they have over 30,000 individual members representing 88 countries and 95 corporate members. Their people are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology. Visit them at AIAA.org. And again, if any of you are planning to be at Space 2017 in Orlando around September 11th or 12th through the 14th, please let me know. I'd love to meet up with you at that event. I am planning to be there. Celestis is a sponsor. They are the iconic pioneer and the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. Their Earthrise mission launched a symbolic portion of cremated remains, or DNA, into space and returned the capsule to Earth, creating a keepsake unlike any other. And Earthrise missions have been flown from Spaceport America, which is in New Mexico. Mission 8, their Star Seeker flight, is being scheduled to launch from Spaceport America November 15th. Attending family members experience an up-close look and tour at Up Aerospace Mission Control and an on-pad viewing of the Space Loft XL rocket as part of their three-day memorial celebration, which comes to an end when they launch at sunrise. New Mexico is one of the six launch locations for Celestis. And if you know of somebody or have a loved one that you would like to honor and memorialize this way, give them a call and tell them you heard about it on the Space Show. www.celestis.com. And again, in the name of full disclosure, I am their customer. I participated in several flights with my mom and my dogs, and they're probably the finest, if not one of the finest, companies I've ever worked with in my entire life, and I love those people, and it's an amazing experience, and what a way to honor people. So Celestis.com, check them out. And Bruce Pittman is back with us, and Bruce, one of the things that has just blossomed like mad are crowdfunding ways to finance a space venture. And I know not all crowdfunding ways are things that we probably want to talk about, but are you seeing crowdfunding as a significant way to jumpstart an entrepreneurial space business?
Yeah, I think it has been kind of surprising at how well that's worked in some cases. I think one of the things you got to look at is what are you trying to accomplish with your crowdfunding. I think one of the things here is obviously to get some money and all that, but it actually has more potential than that. One of the things that if you'd go talk to VCs and or angel investors and you ask them what do they think about crowdsourcing, one of the things that it shows is that there's interest in whatever that the company is trying to do, and especially if you're offering your product for sale that you're going to do, like Spire, when they first started off, was called NanoSatisfy, and they were going to fly little Arduinos, and that people could then do messages and things like that on this with their, that they could do on the ground that would then flash in space. And And so you could see that there was a lot of interest in that, and that got them some visibility, and then they were part of the business plan competition that we held in conjunction with the New Space, and that got them some more visibility, got them into an accelerator, and then that allowed them to get some initial seed funding, and then, you know, they were kind of off to the races. They had to do a couple of strategic pivots in there, because one of the things they were going after originally was the education market, and we said, well, nothing against the education market, but teachers have no money. And so they did a couple of strategic pivots in there, and were able to be successful. But I think that this idea that it's more than money, that it's also, but the other part I would do, having run some of these wearing my NSS hat, be careful about what you're promising to give away, in order to get those things, and make sure that it makes sense and that you don't logistically, you know, create a nightmare for yourself of having, you know, can you withstand success? So I think those are some of the words of wisdom that I would have. There have been a lot of changes in the rules, therefore, so not only can you do kind of Indiegogo and those kind of Kickstarter kinds of things, but there's some other mechanisms that are available. So one of the things you really need to kind of look at is, what are the rules to this? And each company is a little bit different, so you want to make sure that you understand. Some of them you get what you call in. The other one, some of them, if you don't meet the goal, you don't get anything. And then usually these companies do take a percentage, so you want to make sure that you're comfortable with whatever percentage that they're going to take. But I think it is kind of an interesting way to get started.
I do know that they have equity crowdfunding now. I've not come across an equity funding crowdfunding deal to talk about on the Space Show yet, but I do know it's out there, and I think there are some people planning or thinking about doing it, or maybe getting ready to done, or maybe have done it. And I guess the other thing I would throw out just as a cautionary tale, that mostly there is no due diligence on the part of the crowdfunding company to make sure the people who get the money do what they say they're going to do with the money. So do your own due diligence, people, and buyer beware. But absolutely spend some time and be comfortable with management and with their game plan, which is depicted on the crowdfunding website. I think that's really crucial. Have you come across an equity-funded crowdfunding deal yet?
I've heard some people talking about it, but I haven't actually seen one yet.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I do know the SEC put out some specific rules for it, so it can be done, and I am waiting for someone to bring one to my attention. I'm real anxious to see how it works. And you have a question by email from Dr. Doug in Southern California. Hi, Bruce. GEOCOMSATs make up the greatest part of the business in space. That business has been around for decades, yet that commercial success hasn't obviously led to space settlement. Likewise, the growing areas in commercial space seem to be small sats, small launchers, satellite constellations, Earth observation, and the like. It is not obvious to me that these commercial ventures will lead to space settlement. What do you think? Is there some path between these commercial ventures and space settlement?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it depends on whether you're looking, you know, kind of the direct route or the indirect route. I think, you know, and again, this is my personal opinion, that one of the things you're going to need to get to space settlement is you're going to need a well-functioning and robust space economy in order to do that. So to me, anything that helps build that space economy, and what you'd like with something is you know, it's called the virtuous cycle, where as the costs come down, and then it gets easier to do anything, and then more people want to go do it. So that's what we're hoping on here. So it's called market elasticity. So one of the things you're looking for is some things that have elastic markets, so that not clear that communication satellites, you know, geosatcoms are in that market. I know that some of the companies have just announced, you know, layoffs because there's just not enough orders for these geosatcoms. And I think some of these smaller platforms are beginning to offer some competition. So you're starting to see some evolution in the marketplace here. But I think some of the things like the space manufacturing things that I was talking about, on-orbit assembly of large space structures and additive manufacturing in space, like the Arconaut that the maiden space guys and the experiments that the guys in Tethers Unlimited up in Washington are doing, I think is pretty exciting, as far as the ability to be able to, produce and assemble large space structures in space. And then, you know, obviously the resources, the mining, I think those are the kind of infrastructure that you would need. If you can take large amounts of mass there, then that starts to provide you with the kind of infrastructure and capability that you would need if you were going to send people there as well. And then the kind of the big unknown in all this is deep space tourism. So supposedly, you know, Elon said he's got two people that have want to go around the moon, and they're willing to pay a significant amount of money to go do that. And so they're looking to do that either at the sometime within the next year and a half or 2 years. So if you can start doing that and that turns out to be a real market, then that could be interesting as well. And so a lot of places start off with more of a tourism kind of thing, but once you put that infrastructure in, then that could be the nucleation point for some kind of settlement.
I would think the need to have a functioning cislunar infrastructure would be a big catalyst for space settlement. Don't you think so?
That certainly could be part of it, depending on where you want that settlement to be. But there's been a lot of people that have looked at settlements on the moon and things like that, and what kind of capabilities. I mean, that's what Jim is talking about with the moon base summit. There's been a lot of meetings over there. You know, we had extensive discussions at the International Space Development Conference in St. Louis, in May. And then also, you know, at the New Space Conference. So there's been a lot of discussions about this. But we're finally beginning to see, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting was the proposal that the Bezos and the Blue Origin folks made for their Blue Moon, which is cargo delivery service to the surface of the moon. And they had a series of things, and they were saying that they could start this off. And again, they wanted to do this as a public-private partnership, but they were saying that if they could get some kind of a reasonable start, that this was something that they could have within a few years. They were talking about being able to do something by 2020.
Would there be a market for anything going to the surface of the moon for them?
Well, this is one of the things where NASA is put out RFIs looking for soliciting both sources sought for delivery of payloads to the lunar surface, as well as the delivery of people interested in sending payloads to the surface of the moon. And so I'm a member of the Lunar Exploration Analysis Group. They have a commercial advisory board that I'm on, and so I know that the lunar scientists are definitely interested in sending their instruments to the moon, and there's a lot of data that they would like to collect. And then I know there's a certain number of entrepreneurs that are also not only the guys that are going after the Google Lunar X Prize, but a wider community than that would really like to look and see what's there and to see how reasonably this could be extracted, and if there is some kind of a market that you could get the market to the business plan to close for extracting those resources.
Doug, you want more from Bruce, give us a call or send in another note, but perhaps you're satisfied with the response Bruce has given you. Linda in Seattle has an email for you, and again, listeners, we do prefer phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. Maybe
we don't bite.
Well, we don't bite. Maybe you're all listening to baseball games or something. I don't know. Anyway, Linda says... you're talking a lot about commercial opportunities and things that are plausible for the moon. Is there anything new space-oriented or commercial-oriented that is legitimate for Mars?
Again, I think, you know, especially robotically, I think the answer to that is yes. It's just a lot harder. You know, the moon is 3 or 4 days away, and the Mars is just much further away, and no private entity has landed on Mars. Even the SpaceX folks are pulling back on their initial Red Dragon kind of a concept, and Elon's decided that they're going to refocus their energies on a new way of doing it that supposedly he's going to roll out in Adelaide next month in Australia. And so I'm going to be there as well for that. So I was in Guadalajara for the first one, so now I get to see the revised version here. But, so I think that the answer is yes, but I think the moon is a lot easier and a lot more straightforward. And I just don't know what you could do on the moon on Mars, that would make economic sense unless, you know, somebody just wanted to go do it for the sake of doing it. So I guess I think that that's going to come, but I think we need to put some of this, we get some of this infrastructure, some of this heavy lift, and some of these landers. So I think some of the lander technology that they're developing for the moon could be repurposed for Mars. So if you could come up with something that was smaller, simpler, like one of the things that obviously would have a lot of value if you could do it would be a sample return from Mars. That would be amazing, but again, that's a pretty challenging task.
Well, and you'd have some planetary protection issues to deal with that too. So
yeah, probably a lot of forms to fill out. Yeah,
the company would have a lot of costs involved that weren't really mission costs, but bureaucratic costs, I would imagine. But during the break, I asked you if you were seeing any influx of we're going to keep this close to the chest. This is proprietary. We're going to fly under the radar because we got the hottest thing going and we don't want anyone to steal it from us. Are you seeing any of that emerging yet in the new space industry?
Yeah, I am. I would say a significant amount. Obviously, I can't talk about it, but I am seeing it. And as a matter of fact, I had somebody in here yesterday that you know you all would know well, and he was running an idea behind me, and it was just pretty cool. It's kind of really off the main track of what most people are thinking about with space, but he thinks that he can, you know, go do something with it. So I mean, those are the kinds of things that you want to look at. This is part of that virtuous cycle when, you know, somebody can say, well, if this kind of capability is there, then I could take and go do this, or I could go do that, or I could do this thing over here that nobody ever thought of before.
Did you sign an NDA on that deal?
I didn't, but
good. You can tell us about it then.
It's part of my deal of working, you know, as a contractor for the government. I am bound by my non-disclosure with NASA. So,
even though you didn't sign an NDA, how disgusting!
Yeah, I know, it's really a bummer. Yeah, but it'll be worth it in the long run.
So usually this type of behavior starts to materialize when people are pretty convinced there are real opportunities out there, because otherwise, you know, they would either be a flake doing this or the serious people wouldn't be doing this.
Well, I think that the important thing here is, you know, if you go back and you look at the, you know, another one of the studies that we did was the study that the Tory group, which I guess is now
something different. Yeah, I know.
You know, the Bryce, but you know,
yeah.
they did another study for us, basically looking at the investment in space that's happened over the last, and the increase in that's happened over the last, you know, say since 2000, 2005, and you know, the remarkable growth there, and you know, you could say that, well, there's always been investment, but, you know, it's one thing when somebody's investing their own money, but if you're investing other people's money, like what venture capital firms do, you know, I don't know if you remember, but years ago we participated you know, with me and about 10 other folks, we put together this Space Investment Summit series, and we'd go around the country and kind of try to educate the investment community on space and
right.
and educate the space community on how to get investment. And, you know, the one thing that became really clear, so one of the things that we had in 2007, we had Steve Urbitson from DFJ come and talk about why he wasn't investing in space. And he was very clear. He said, although I like space a lot and I think space is really cool, you know, I haven't seen a deal yet that I could take to my partners and show how it could pencil out. And then when he made the investment in SpaceX, you know, we invited him back, and he came back, and he said, what had changed? And what had changed was that SpaceX had not only flown their vehicle successfully, but that they had won the CRS, the Commercial Resupply Services contract, which was a $1.6 billion contract for delivery of cargo to the International Space Station. And Urbitson said, once we saw that, then you could see how this penciled out and how it could be clear at least a path to profitability and success, and that's what allowed him to go make the case to his partners and do the financing. It doesn't mean there wasn't any risk at that point, but at least, you know, they could see how it could pencil out.
Having some kind of product in hand and some kind of success is really important rather than just an idea. That's a sort of a takeaway, right?
Yeah, I mean, the further along that you can get things, so let me put a plug in for the government here. If you really just got an idea and you want to do something, there's a number of government programs out there that you could look at. If it's a more near-term thing, all of the major government agencies that do research and development participate in the Small Business Innovative Research program, the SBIR program. The DOD does it. NASA does it. You know, pretty much everybody that does R&D, I think above $100 million a year, participates in this program. So those solicitations come out every year. This is mandated by Congress. And so going through those and see, is there a topic there? Now, it's not a ton of money, but I think, you know, it's like phase one is like $75,000, and then you can get up to $750,000 in a phase two. For those kinds of things, if it's a more far out idea, it's a little further in the future, maybe 10 or 20 years out, then a NIAC, a NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts, is a program that you could apply to. The neat thing here is there's a competition, but once you do that, you're not giving up any equity. So you're not having to give up any equity. You get some money. You're pretty free to kind of do it the way that you want to do it once you win. And the neat thing about like winning an SBIR is that if your technology proves out, then you can go and be sole sourced for NASA or any kind of government program that would use that technology, and you do not have to recompete it since you already went through a competition process. So that's another advantage that you get. So if this works out and somebody wants to use it, then they can just basically sole source that to you because you've already gone through the competitive process.
You have another question from Dr. Doug in Southern California, and says he's at work so he can't call in. Bruce Andrew Rush, the president of Made in Space, testified before the House Space Subcommittee. In his testimony, he candidly stated that if there was a commercial LEO station, then his company would have to pay market rates for launch to that station. He indicated that it would be very difficult to break even if he had to pay those rates. So how confident can we be that a commercial station could support itself instead of being an ongoing burden on national space budgets, which would then not be free for things such as funding companies to develop a lunar base? Don't get me wrong, I support commercial space, but I'm trying to figure out how it fits into the broader vision that the space cadets or space advocates have. And Bruce, I would add to it that the CubeSat guys that are getting rideshare are not paying market rates either. But if they're going to launch on vector or on Rocket or any of these little rockets that are going up, they are going to pay market rates. And do they have that kind of funding, and is it going to be worth it for them to name their own orbit and their own launch date rather than go along with rideshare? Those are big issues.
Well, I don't know the answer to everybody, but I know at least some of those guys that I've talked to, and they said, yeah, they would rather pay more market rates and be able to launch. Their problem is they just can't get the launches, or they can't get the launches where they want them or when they want them, and so they would rather have that problem. I think that it is going to be a little bit of both, and the idea here is not that you totally go one way or the other, but let's assume that there was going to be some kind of a public research kind of thing. So the space station is going to last at least until 2024. So that gives us some time. So that's 7 years or more out there. Could be extended longer, depends. Clearly the ISS, I think it's fair to say, is not designed as a manufacturing facility. And so one of the questions is if you actually could prove out something on the ISS that you then wanted to manufacture in space, then where do you go? What do you do? What do you transition to? And then I think the other part of that question that's not clear is, it's not clear what these guys are going to charge. If you can get some of the reusability in these launch vehicles and the launch prices come down and they can start looking for, it's just like with the secondary payload, now you've got people that are going there that want first class treatment and all that. But if you can just have your stuff be crammed in a corner there and you don't require a lot of handholding, maybe you get a cheaper rate, like, third class steerage, on the transatlantic ships 100 years ago. I think it's going to be interesting to see how this market emerges, and with competition is good for everybody. I think that has the potential for bringing prices down, but we'll have to see.
And we shouldn't have to wait too long, because I think this stuff will start to materialize within the next couple of years.
Yep.
So, okay, Doug, hopefully you're satisfied with that. If not, we've got 10 more minutes left of our show tonight, so fire off another email to us. And listeners, there is still time if you want to get an email in or call us, 1-866-687-7223. I cannot believe that we're almost through with 2017. Is there anything in the new space, commercial space horizon for this year that bears watching that you can think of?
I think what a lot of us have been waiting for since like 2011 was the Falcon Heavy to fly. So I desperately want to see that thing fly and be successful. So I think that's kind of what I'm actually over here. I have bought myself, I went to their website and I bought myself a Falcon Heavy hat. So when the Falcon Heavy flies, I'm going to go put on my Falcon Heavy hat. So that's one of the things I'm looking for. Elon is now saying November. And then I think early next year with the milestones for both SpaceX and Boeing for the commercial crew, I think that's going to be really exciting to watch those things happen. Boeing's going to do their pad abort test. SpaceX is going to do their in-flight abort test. Then they're going to do uncrewed flights. And then by, at least next year, this time, hopefully, both of them, if they keep to the schedules that they have right now, they're both going to have flown people in space on their vehicles. So, like you said, we're not going to have long to wait to see how this stuff plays out. This doesn't mean there couldn't be problems or anything, but I think it's really exciting. And then the question is, now that you've got that, how can you put these pieces together in new and interesting ways to go do things in space?
Bobby is in Denver, Colorado, with an email, and he says, I haven't heard you mention the suborbital companies like Virgin Galactic. Any thoughts on the commercial uptake on how the suborbital industry is going to shape up? Do you think it will be a good moneymaker and will actually happen?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it is going to be I think it is going to happen. I think people are going to try it. You know, my big question is just how big is the market going to be? And I think it has to do a lot with the customer experience. So clearly there's some science that you can do. There's a commercial suborbital, you know, research group that Sarge that was set up that a number of years ago. So there was a lot of excitement about that. It's just taken much longer than everybody thought. You know, the XPRIZE, and sorry, XPRIZE was won in 2004, and here we are in 2017, and nobody has duplicated what they did back in 2004. I think if you'd ask any of us back then in 2004, you know, Richard Branson thought he'd be flying in 2007 or 2008. And it's just taken much longer than anybody thought. So that's one thing, and I think that's caused some, you know, loss of kind of enthusiasm because people have waited so long. And then I think the other big question that's going to be is what's the customer experience? What if everybody comes back and says, wow, that's the greatest thing that ever happened in my life, you know, sign me up, I want to go again, you know, like Thunder Mountain at Disneyland, then I think then this could be off and to the races. But the question is do you get repeat customers and is the market going to grow and all those kind of fundamental marketing, questions. So, you've got Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin are the two, you know, main U.S. players right now. There's some international folks that are looking to get into this as well, but right now it's between those two. And I know at the I don't know if you went through that, David, at the Space Foundation conference, but Bezos had
he had the capsule
there, New Shepard capsule and all that, and apparently it was a big hit.
Oh, the lines were 24/7 if they would have kept it open that long. Even the day it snowed, there were lines there after they took the covers off of it. For a while they had the covers on it. But and they gave you about a 15-minute experience inside of it. So they put seven people in at a time, but the lines were always long. Now for the rocket, you could just walk up to it and photograph it and see it and all of that. But to get in the capsule, there was perpetually a line for it. There was so much interest in it.
Yeah, so I think that bodes well. I mean, now the one thing that Blue Origin hasn't announced yet is what's their price structure going to be. So I think that'll be another interesting thing to see when they do announce their pricing. They haven't started taking reservations yet.
That, as I understand it, that flies without a pilot or a crew, and it's all controlled by here on Earth, right?
Yep. Yep.
So how do you feel about that? Would you get in it?
I would, yep.
Have you been in a self-driving car yet?
No.
I know you've seen them around. They're all over the Bay Area.
Yeah, they've got a lot of them here, and we have a lot of them on the campus here.
Oh, really?
We have a deal with both Nissan and Tesla for testing out their vehicles here. So, I... You know, clearly it's not without some issues, but I think given the state of the art of the technology and looking, you know, like how amazing it's been to watch these first stage of these Falcon 9s come back from space and land. I mean, that certainly has filled me with a lot. And then you watch the new Shepard from Bezos come in and land, you know, go up, come back down and land. They did it five times in a row, so, I mean, that's not certainty, but it certainly is a step in the right direction. And I know they're going to do a lot more of those before they start sending paying passengers up there. So I think by the time they do that, I feel comfortable doing that.
Well, you can come on
the show. As long as somebody wants to buy me a ticket, you know. Yeah,
come on the show and tell us what it was like. Or maybe you'll be the designated crew member that can take control if the computers fail or something, and can fly it. I don't know that I would do that one. But I don't know that I would get in a self-driving car either. So we'll see. I think I'm too schooled in the old ways for that. Are you going to go down to Florida for the Falcon Heavy launch?
I don't know the end. It kind of depends on schedules. You know, my schedule. I am going to be down at the Space 2017 in Orlando in a couple of weeks, so maybe we can meet up there, David. But my schedule in September and October is crazy, and so frankly, I'm looking forward to staying home for a while. But I don't know. It depends
on
how
see.
Things work out.
Hawaii, Australia, Orlando. You have a busy schedule coming up.
And then there's a league meeting, and then back in Maryland in October. So yeah, it's gonna be crazy.
Are you staying longer in Orlando or coming back when the conference ends?
Actually, I'm gonna go down. So I just pretty much have to go. I actually have to leave the conference in before it ends, so I've got to leave Wednesday to go up to NASA headquarters for some meetings up there. So I actually can't even stay for the whole meeting.
I may be leaving too. I'm waiting to hear from them. When I did the Space Foundation's NASA Center panel, Cabana promised me golden inside special amazing grand tour of Kennedy Space
mm-hmm.
Center, which I've had before as part of ISU, but I took him up on it, and I'm waiting for the tour date, which could be any time during AIAA, but I'm also going down to Cocoa for a few days, so it could be once the conference ends, too. I need to call my director at Kennedy to find out when that's going to be. Want to go on a special tour?
Yeah, that sounds like that would be great.
Have you ever been on one of those inside tours of Kennedy Space Center?
I have a number of friends down there, and I've launched some spacecraft from there myself. So,
I'm looking forward to going up on the Falcon Heavy pad. So, that is in the Lockheed thing where they're doing the habitat study with the old shuttle, commercial tanks or whatever they're called, cargo tanks, that they're turning into simulated habitat hotels or whatever you call them. For their for an 18-month contract with NASA on how to do this orbital space station around the moon.
Yeah, this deep space gateway.
Deep space gateway. So, a lot of interesting things happening. Anything we should have talked about with you tonight that we have overlooked or forgotten, or that you wanted to make sure you talked about? I know you mentioned you wanted to talk about ISDC coming up.
Yeah, I wanted to say that the next year's ISDC, the International Space Development Conference, is going to be in L.A., so it's going to be a really good event. It'll be Memorial Day weekend, as it always is, down in L.A. at the L.A. Sheraton. So really like everybody to put that on their calendar and help us to move the program forward.
If you want to present at a track, is it too early to send in an idea or a paper?
Probably, it's probably a little bit early from that. We're still putting the things together, but we will probably put out the announcement for that shortly. John Mankins is the conference chair down in L.A., and he's doing a really great job of pulling everything together.
Okay. Bruce, thank you very much for coming back on the Space Show, and happy to talk to you again, and we certainly appreciate all the insights and wisdom and stories that you've been able to share with us tonight.
Well, thank you, David, and good luck to everybody out there, and happy landings.
Right, and if not before, I will see you in Orlando. I look forward to it. And everybody have a great rest of the week. And Hotel Mars talks to the guy who says there's a lot of water at the equator of Mars based on Mars Odyssey programs. He's over at the Applied Physics Lab, and he is on the show tomorrow. And then Friday and Sunday, we go back to open lines. Everybody have a great week. Thanks to Bruce for being with us, all of you who emailed us, for Jim for his phone call from across the Pacific. Keep looking up. Good night from the Space Show.